When we think through regulation, we really cannot think of in economics what we call static models, where you observe a behavior and you design some optimal scheme reacting to that observation. What you have to think through is sort of the dynamics and the game that's being played by the regulator and the regulated agent. And sometimes you'll have these reactions being also not possible for researchers or the government to anticipate.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Regulators will tell you that the people they regulate often find surprising ways to work around the rules, whether those people are selling real estate or hot dogs. And one market in which regulation is essential is fishing, and that's what we're talking about today. So can the government in Chile enforce regulation to protect its endangered fish stocks? An experiment in local markets shows that the most effective strategy might not be the one you think it is. Ahmed Mushfiq Mubarak of Yale University was one of the researchers who conducted the experiment. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you very much for having me, Tim.
I think it's welcome back, isn't it?
Yes, we talked about a very different issue last time in Malawi on agriculture. Today it's fishing in Chile.
Well, I'm delighted to have you back. Ahmed, I remember interviewing a financial trader a couple of years ago, and he told me that he welcomed good, clear regulation because it actually helped him think up ways to get around it. Is this sort of thing always a problem?
Yes, unfortunately, I think it is. There's this cat and mouse game always that's happening between regulators and the entities they try to regulate, right? And there's always adaptation and sometimes illicit adaptation to new regulation. So this was an issue. I mean, while we'll talk a lot about fish and fishing markets today, this was a big issue during the last big, Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, just passed in 2010 after, the big global financial crisis, where there was a view that there was a lot of deregulation that had happened and that had allowed Wall Street to get away with really bad behavior. However, when people evaluated the new regulations that came up in 2010, and here's a quote, "A major problem with the new financial legislation is that it's responsive to past market innovations without being sensitive to future innovations. The problem is that in these sectors, the actors will not always behave in a predictable way. And that's the genius of financial innovation. The market always looks for new opportunities for profit. As the dawn follows the dark, mischief may arise." And that's the issue with pretty much every market.
Okay, so this market in particular, the fish stocks in Chile, why do they need regulating?
So the important reason is that as with many, many different global fish stocks, the population of the Pacific hake fish, called merluza locally in Chile, it's severely threatened and the population is actually close to the threat of complete collapse. And it's important because hake is the protein of choice for a lot of middle and low-income Chileans. And therefore, if the population collapses, that's going to raise the cost of protein for low-income folks. But that is also partly the source of the problem, which is that there's been overconsumption that's been happening. And in the absence of proper market regulation and management, you're going to get into the problems where that source of food will not be sustainable.
Now, who's catching these fish? Is it big organizations or is it small fishermen? And where are they being sold?
The problem partly is because it's a lot of small fishermen. I say that's a problem because these artisanal fishermen, you cannot regulate them in the same way that you might go after one or two large companies, right? Not that that's easy, that has its own set of challenges. But the government of Chile, the problem is that you have literally hundreds or thousands of small businesses. So like a couple of guys with a small boat that's maybe, 8 feet long, that's a business. That's a separate business. And given how decentralized and artisanal it is, it's difficult for you to regulate. You cannot just monitor the books of one or two or three large firms. So that's how the fish is caught. And the other issue is where it's sold. And that's also, again, decentralized. So lots of fish vendors who operate in around various cities in sort of semi-formal markets, they go and purchase from the fishermen and then they sell in various neighborhoods across all of Chile.
Now, I imagine that this is a problem that's been going on for a while. So how have these markets been regulated in the past and how successful has that been?
There has been a combination of things. Sometimes you try to appeal for people's sense of their environmental concerns. So then you can tell people, maybe go directly to consumers and say, oh, please don't eat this fish. This is harmful. And we've seen this, you know, and sometimes then you can get cards now before you go to restaurants that tell you what types of fish are okay to order versus not.
Oh, yes,
being environmentally conscious. So there's that type of strategy. Another possible strategy is through direct bans, but then you have to worry about enforcement of those bans. And herein lies the problem with having a lot of small fishermen. So if there is a ban, but there are hundreds or thousands of actors, it's much more expensive for you to enforce that ban. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you could just have one or two large players and you could sort of enforce large penalties on them, maybe that would have been an easier solution. So there's a whole bunch of strategies, both on the carrot and the stick side, or information side and penalty side, that governments have been trying.
So what new type of intervention did you try in this experiment, in this trial?
The first choice that we had to make jointly with the government of Chile is that we would try to regulate the fish vendors as opposed to the fishermen. And the reason is that when you have thousands of fishermen and they're out in the open waters, and now I'm sure many of your listeners know about the geography of Chile. It's a very long, thin country.
Looks like a big piece of bacon, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Given the miles and miles of coastline, there's many different beaches that the fishermen can come into, right? Mm. So it's not easy for us to set up some kind of regulatory activity out in the open waters where it's very expensive for the government to monitor. So instead, they decided that it would be cheaper for them to monitor on land. And I think another reason for that choice was partly political. In the past, when the Chilean government had tried to regulate the fishermen directly, they are a well-organized group, and there was like ransacking of their offices and so forth that was in the news. And so they decided to go further downstream and regulate in markets on land where fish is being sold. Our discussion with the government led to a two-pronged strategy. We said, okay, let's try to help you enforce the ban, where as researchers, we came in with, you know, based on, say, financial markets and other markets, we know that people are going to try and circumvent this ban. They're going to try and adapt. And we're going to try and set up variations in your enforcement scheme such that we can track what those adaptations might be and how well your enforcement works in the face of that adaptation, designing the enforcement scheme carefully. In another arm, we decided to benchmark this enforcement activity against running a big information campaign in partnership with the government. So the information campaign involved, number one, sending out letters by post to tens of thousands of Chilean households, telling them why it's environmentally harmful to eat the merluza this particular month. And not only did we have letters, we also had posters in all these public places, like at bus stops and so forth, and we handed out brochures and things like that. So there was a big information campaign using multiple media, and a very specific time that we chose was linked to a very specific government policy, which is the government bans the consumption of this fish and fishing during the month of September each year. And the reason for that is that September corresponds to the reproductive cycle of the fish.
Ah,
so it's particularly environmentally harmful for you to take out the fish during that month before they've had a chance to give birth to their progeny.
How can you even set a benchmark when you're doing research like this? Because, of course, you can't send researchers along with a clipboard to a market and say to the market traders, are you breaking the law or not today, can you? So how do you work out whether or not they are selling this fish?
Right. Okay, so this takes me back to one of the first days of our field work. You know, I was walking around with my co-author on this project is Andres Gonzalez Lira, who just finished his PhD at Berkeley. And then we had a very close collaboration with PUC, the Catholic University in Santiago. We hired some research assistants who were students in Santiago. So I was going around visiting various markets in the towns of Valparaíso, Viña del Mar, observing what these fish markets look like and what the interaction with customers look like, etc. So I'm going to try and help you visualize what the markets are like.
Yes,
so imagine like there's a street where normally there's traffic, but then on Monday morning, that street for 4 hours gets taken over by a bunch of vendors with stalls.
Yeah.
So they all close off like one block and they set up and they're selling fish and vegetables and other things that people like to eat. And then there are people from the neighborhood are coming with shopping bags and buying the produce they need. And then what would happen is that the same group of vendors with their stalls, they would move to a different part of the city on, say, Wednesday morning and set up there. So they're not a permanent installation, but it's the same group of vendors that are moving around in what we call a circuit. One of the other things I noticed is that as this set of stalls are set up, the most typical shopper, I would say, would be something like a middle-aged woman who is shopping for her family.
Yeah.
That seemed to be the typical case, right? And then I noticed that there was a term that the fish vendors were using, like a casera, which I guess, would translate to housewife, right? Owned by my fish. You know how vendors would call out to potential customers. So that made me think, like, no, we cannot send our surveyors or university students with a clipboard to collect data, because obviously we're trying to track an illegal activity. And as soon as you send somebody that looks like an enumerator, then you're not going to get a correct recording of what actually happens. So instead, we decided, oh, let's hire some of these typical looking shoppers. So we actually went out and recruited a bunch of, say, middle-aged women who would look like, yeah, they would be buying fish so that they wouldn't stand out in any way.
And
they never went with clipboards. We just trained them in advance to go with a shopping bag and try to negotiate the price of fish and buy some fish sometimes and talk to the vendors. And then as soon as they're done, record for us what went on, what the interaction was like. So in terms of number one, was hakefish available for sale? What was the price? And the other thing that we thought of was that, oh, one of the adaptations would be like when there's a ban in place and possible enforcement, and especially when we try to introduce systematic enforcement in these markets, the fish would just go underground, so to speak. They would sell it off the back of the van, that they won't be displayed openly. We anticipated that. So we also trained our, well, let's call them mystery shoppers. We trained them to ask for if they have any hake in the back, should it not be visibly being advertised in front.
So is this how they worked around the regulation?
Yes, they did do this. So what we anticipated did happen. There's a lot of hidden hake being sold, but there's also other things that we learned later that we had not anticipated. And I guess this goes back to our early conversation about how new adaptation occurs that the regulator themselves wouldn't be able to figure out. So let me tell you about that. Yeah, so we tracked sort of open, visible sales of hake. We track the hidden sales of hake from the back. But we also learned very quickly from our mystery shoppers that the vendors were keeping the hake on ice to give it a frozen look, claiming that, oh, this hake was caught back in August when it was legal to do so. So it's not September hake.
Right? I see. Yes.
And so now the question is that actually true? Well, even if it was true, like the displacement of hake to August, like extra catching in August would not necessarily help the fish population. So when our mystery shoppers, when they encountered this phenomenon of frozen hake, when they tried to negotiate the price, the fisherman often was like, no, you have to give me the fresh price for it because it's actually fresh. I'm just saying it. So that's the value of using mystery shoppers as opposed to people with clipboards.
Well, what we learn in labor economics about, you know, when people choose to break the rules or not break the rules is the likelihood of punishment. So I suppose the best way to do it is just to do more enforcement and enforce, you know, every day instead of once every 2 weeks. Is that going to work?
Yeah, we also thought that would be true. Okay, so let me tell you why that might have been sensible thinking at the outset, but we got surprised. Remember, I was talking about the circuits where these vendors are moving around from one market to another to a different neighborhood. So then my thinking was, just like they're going to do these hidden sales, the other thing I could anticipate is that maybe what they'll do is if I go in and enforce once a week, so I only catch them in one of their markets, right? That would simply displace the hake sales to a different market where they set up. Like if they can't sell on Monday, they'll just sell on Tuesday or Wednesday. So that made me think, you know what? One way we can get around that is let's increase our enforcement intensity so that we follow around these vendors to all markets where they operate in that circuit.
It sounds sensible, yes.
So that way they won't be able to just simply displace it from one day of the week to the next. Now, it turns out that backfired. And what happened instead is that we observed that when you do this high intensity enforcement, it does not have as large an effect on reducing hake sales as when you do much lower intensity enforcement of like just one day a week. And so we try to study this very carefully using both economic theory and then bringing data to bear on the implications of that theory. And what we learn is that what happens here is learning, right? So if we send enforcers out. So what's happening? So separate from our mystery shoppers, the other thing that's happening here is the intervention itself, which is the Chilean National Marine Resource Authority called Cernapesca. They're sending their monitors out to some of these randomly chosen markets so that we can track what the effects of the enforcement are. And so what we see is that every time the vendor has an interaction with one of the enforcement monitors, they learn about exactly how that system is working. And the quicker they learn, the quicker they can adapt. And this frozen hake sales that I alluded to, so what they learned was actually it turns out that hake sales in September itself is banned. It doesn't matter if you caught it in August. So if you were to go by the letter of the law, you shouldn't be able to sell hake in September, regardless of when it was caught. So this frozen thing really should not work, right? And what we learned is that the Cernapisca monitors, if the vendor had this sort of plausible deniability on the basis of sort of the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were more likely to look the other way or not impose these fines. And one reason is that the fine, when it's imposed, is quite large. You know, you confiscate all the fish from the vendor, plus you levy like the equivalent of a $200 fine. So it seems like the monitors were a bit reticent to impose this very large penalty if there was some kind of a plausible deniability. The other type of variation that we tried was predictable versus unpredictable schedule of enforcement.
Yes.
So the predictable schedule would be, you know, the Cernapisca monitors visit this particular market like at 9 a.m. on Monday, this other market at 9 a.m. on Wednesday. So the problem with that is that that's another opportunity to quickly learn, right? If you learn the enforcement schedule, then what you do is you don't bring the hake out or you hide the hake during that period, and then you can openly displace it after the monitors have left. So what we tried to convince our government partners is to say, okay, you know what? Let the research team set up the monitoring schedule and we'll just tell you a day in advance. It was actually difficult. That was the single most difficult thing for us to convince them to do, persuade them to do, even though it sounds like that should be an obvious thing to do, making it less predictable. But the reason is administrative, which is that, you know, they have a set staff and trucks that they have to allocate, like government resources that they have to allocate. And the problem is that unless they know in advance what the schedule should be, it becomes very difficult for them to allocate because sometimes they have a truck in the wrong place or something like that. So anyhow, for the purposes of research, they agreed to do this. And what we learn is that the unpredictable schedule actually works much, much better. So essentially what we learned from the enforcement arm is if you were to do it at low frequency and implement the unpredictable schedule for that particular month of September of 2016, it actually works quite well. And we see large and statistically significant reductions in hake sales. Now, when you make it predictable or when you make it higher frequency, those effect sizes dissipate as agents learn faster, right? So what we learned from the enforcement side is this interplay between sort of the enforcement capacity as well as the learning and illicit adaptation and so forth. And that interplay teaches us a lot about when regulations work and when they're more likely to fail.
I see. So if that turns out not to be a good solution, then I suppose the other arm of your intervention comes into play, trying to reduce the demand overall so fewer fish are caught using that information campaign. Was that working?
So we do see, again, statistically significant reductions in hake sales in the other randomly chosen markets where we did the information campaign. Okay. Now, the information campaign did not produce exactly as large an effect as the unpredictable low frequency monitoring, but it did produce larger effects than sort of predictable monitoring. So it falls somewhere in between. And so the demand side is, I think, is important because, you know, even against the say, sort of hidden hake or frozen hake sales, you know, your customers can act as a second line of defense when they are environmentally conscious.
So can we come up with an optimal policy or combination of policies here? And I suppose if you do come up with that policy, is the government going to follow it?
I think the information campaign is a sensible thing to pursue, you know, in that we don't have to worry about the adaptation. Now, in the case of the enforcement that we did, right, if you're going to do enforcement, making it unpredictable makes a lot more sense. If there's opportunities for learning, then somewhat surprising thing that we learned from this research is that even if you have really good enforcement capacity, meaning that you have enough agents to go out and monitor on a daily basis, even then, it sometimes pays for the government to withhold some of that capacity and not go out on a daily basis just because of the opportunities for learning that that creates and the adaptation opportunities that it creates. So that's sort of a counterintuitive finding, but I guess it makes a lot of sense once you think through the learning opportunity. And so I'll tell you, actually, rather than trying to talk about what the optimal is, I'll tell you what the government did, because in one sense, the optimal is difficult for us to figure out in the long run. So what I mean by that is, sure, I now figured out that, look, in this particular month or just over a month that we did this intervention, under predictable monitoring, they learned quickly and they adapted. So that doesn't work. Under unpredictable, they didn't, right? However, what I cannot tell you is that over time, if let's say we go with the unpredictable, the point is that if you design the regulation again, like there'll be a second order learning where they'll say, oh, this is what they're
of
now
course.
Doing.
Yes.
Like, so I'm going to come up with some other new innovation, which is not going to be frozen fish. It might be something else, which I cannot anticipate. And it's always like this cat and mouse game where you change the regulation and the agent will try to adapt to it. So I feel like coming up with an optimal and saying, oh yeah, this is the optimal informant strategy, scale this up and hold this forever, I cannot make that claim with a lot of certainty at all. Whereas what the government reacted to this was, yeah, that sounds complicated because we don't know what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And enforcement is costly and difficult, administratively complicated. You know, you can also imagine, not that we saw direct evidence of this, but you can also imagine that the other adaptation that might come up in the future is some form of corruption, and which is going to be very difficult for the government to supervise because of the nature of corruption. So then the government decided, oh, you know what? You know, this information campaign, while it didn't work as well as your unpredictable enforcement, it was good enough. And so we're just going to scale that up. And that's what the government chose to do. And one other thing that they mention in choosing to scale that up that makes a lot of sense that I hadn't thought about is that, oh, you know, we had already created all these posters and letters and brochures, etc., right? So we can just reuse them. It's even easier and it's cheaper for us to just like replicate the strategy nationwide and do it next year again.
Well, the cat and mouse game is the same all over the world in every regulated market, isn't it? But the contexts are very different. So can we learn something that applies in those other contexts from the research you've done here?
I think when we think through regulation, we really cannot think of, in economics, what we call static models, where you observe a behavior and you design some optimal scheme reacting to that observation. What you have to think through is sort of the dynamics and the game that's being played by the regulator and the regulated agent. And sometimes you'll have these reactions being also not possible for researchers or the government to anticipate. And so I think one general lesson is that we need to think through sort of the information transmission, the learning that occurs, and the opportunities for learning, how that will occur. We need to think of those dynamics in any given situation. And the second thing that we learned from this project is that sometimes, rather than dealing with the agent who's going to try and adapt and who's never going to be your friend, who's always going to be working against you, right? Try to figure out who are the other actors who might be your friend, who's going to help you have a sustained impact. In this case, for us, it turned out to be environmentally conscious Chilean consumers.
Well, that's a fascinating piece of research and some really surprising conclusions there. So thank you very much, Ahmed. You're always welcome here.
Thanks very much for having me. I look forward to our next conversation.
Before we get to our next conversation, you'll want to read this piece of research. It's called Slippery Fish, Enforcing Regulation When Agents Learn and Adapt. And the authors are Andres Gonzalez Lira and Ahmed Mushfiq Mubarak. This has been a VoxDev Talk, and the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org.